This weekend, a handful of us were down in the Blue Ridge doing meditation and working with emotional challenges. And one of the themes or one of the questions that came up was, it's a very beautiful inquiry, is how these practices, these inner practices, really inform us in terms of our relationships and really acting on for the good of the world. I mean, what's the relationship between sitting quietly and acting in the world? And of course, it's something that we are all exploring, how we come home to ourselves and then really live from a place of wakefulness with each other. And that's what I'd like to spend some time with tonight, what we call compassion in action. And on purpose, I shared the Hokusai poem because the inner practice of really, and it's courageous, letting life live through us, that openness and presence is the very ground for responding to each other, responding to our world with a genuine kind of compassion. There's a story I really like of a Hasidic rabbi who asked his pupils how they can tell when the night has ended and the day has begun. And he says, for this is really the time for holy prayers. So one student proposes, is it when you can see an animal in the distance and tell whether it is a sheep or a dog? No, answered the rabbi. Is it when you can clearly see the lines on your own palm? No. Is it when you can look at a tree in the distance and tell if it is a fig tree or a pear tree? No, answered the rabbi each time. Then what is it? The pupils demanded. It is when you can look on the face of any man or woman and see that they are your sister or brother. Until then, it is still night. So I was kind of reflecting on why that, there's something in that that really touches me, that what if we could really look at any being and feel that being as our brother or our sister. Not just an idea, but that real level of belonging. And I feel like there's a collective yearning, it's sometimes really buried, but for a world where we do feel that kind of connection. It's why for many of us, and I know I'm not the only one, every time we listen to John Lennon sing Imagine, there's this welling up. Do you know what I mean? There's this something in it that there's a sense of possibility that we'd love to have manifest. That kind of loving. And the truth is that we all, deep down, want to help. Doesn't mean we're always into it in any given moment, but there's something in us that really loves to feel that we're being able to help others, and that in some way our smile or our words or our way of being has reassured someone or comforted them, just brought them a little bit of peace. And so how come? How come that matters? And there's all these levels. Like sometimes we want to help because of our, what I call our good personhood project. You know, it makes us feel good about ourselves. I'm a helpful person. I'm worthy. It undoes the trance of unworthiness. And sometimes it's because we want others to then we, you know, there's chits and they owe us, and there's that kind of thing, payback time. But there's something much deeper, and that is that our deepest experience of who we are is loving presence and is a sense of connection. And we feel most at home with ourselves, most at home with who we are when there's that care and that spontaneous wanting to help. And even when we're disconnected, and I reflect on this a lot because I can feel how I have the idea about compassion and it's abstract, that my heart's not really resonating. Even when we're disconnected and we're really in a snit in some way, we still care about caring. It still matters to us. It matters that we care, as Hokusai says. So the path of the bodhisattva, and that's just the language of the Buddhist language for the path of an awakening being, and that's each of us. Every one of us is waking up. We would not come here to pay attention to our life in this way if there wasn't some awareness within us, this kind of that wants to realize itself, that wants to come home to the truth that's here. So we're all these awakening bodhisattvas, and there is this, whether you call it spirit or the divine, there's some impulse that we want to wake up. We want to come home to wholeness. And there's this longing to live in love, to not hold back our love, to have our moments be congruent, to not kind of, to not do the church on Sunday thing and then race through our day dissing each other, you know. There's a writer, Mae Sarton, who says, "There is only one real deprivation, I decided this morning, and that is not to be able to give one's gift to those one loves. The gift turned inward, unable to be given, becomes a heavy burden, even sometimes a kind of poison. It is as though the flow of life were backed up." So it's not just it feels good to be caring. It feels really bad when we hold back our love in some way, when we get caught in some habitual defendedness, our habitual preoccupation. And then we know this life's a flash, and there's, you know, someone gets sick, someone dies, and those moments are gone. So this is our predicament a bit, that we really long to realize and live from the fullness of who we are, to be the best we can be with each other. And every day, and it is every day, we get caught up in a kind of trance-like state where we're preoccupied, we're on our way somewhere else, we're trying to get something for ourselves. And I think of this as this kind of trance of separateness, where we get very fixated on a self that's trying to make it through the day. It's one of the best ways I can feel it for myself. I'm trying to get through the day and get certain things done. And so my awareness is contracted. There's not as much room to let life live through me and let others be part of my heart. There's three different ways we get caught in the trance of separation and kind of this contraction. And they show up in how we relate to others. That then others become unreal others. When we're the self trying to get through the day, avoiding things going wrong, checking things off the list, others become unreal. They're either a source of help, potentially. We want something from them. You know, we want them to ease our burden or approve of us or give us something. So that's one way they become unreal others. Or they become a source of possible trouble. They're an obstacle. They're not holding up their end, or they're criticizing us. They're in some way, they're not cooperating. That's another form of the unreal other. And then the third unreal other is when they're neither, but they don't matter. So they're kind of irrelevant and we don't pay attention. So this sense of this trance we go into, where we are kind of shut down, creates others out there. There's a self in here, others out there, and we don't really see who's there. Now, sometimes it's kind of innocent the way we then project onto the others around us. One woman who is a physician told a story about her then 4-year-old daughter. They're on the way to preschool, and she was a doctor and she left her stethoscope on the car seat, and her little girl picked it up and began to play with it. "Be still, my heart," thought my friend. "My daughter wants to follow in my footsteps." Then the child spoke into the instrument. "Welcome to McDonald's. May I take your order?" It's fun, though. You know how parents, I mean, our child can become an extension of self, something to control, something to make us feel proud, something to not make us feel bad about ourselves and like we're bad parents. That's the unreal other. In those moments, we're not seeing the humanness, we're not seeing the spirit. When this, we're in this self-other duality, we spend a lot of our moments in some way controlling others. And what I mean by that is we're trying to control how they think of us. And I think it's really revealing to sense how much we do is based on what others will think of us. We're trying to control also what they do, how they treat us. We want to get our way, basically. The wanting self wants to get its way. One of my favorite descriptions, a story some of you might remember, an old man in Phoenix calls his son in New York and says, "I hate to ruin your day, but I have to let you know your mother and I are divorcing. 45 years of misery, enough already." "Pop, what are you talking about?" the son screams. "We can't stand each other any longer," the old man says. "We're sick and tired of each other. I'm sick of talking about it. So you call your sister in Chicago and tell her," and he hangs up the phone. Frantic, the son calls his sister, who explodes on the phone. "Like hell they're getting a divorce," she shouts. "I'll take care of this." She calls Phoenix immediately and screams at the old man, "You are not getting divorced. Don't do a single thing until I get there. I'm calling my brother back, and we'll both be there tomorrow. Until then, don't do a single thing. Do you hear me?" And she hangs up. The old man hangs up his phone and turns to his wife. "Okay," he says, "they're coming for Thanksgiving, and they're coming for Thanksgiving, and they're paying their own way." So again, unreal other. And, you know, this is blatant, but what do we do to, in some way, control how others do things or think? Of course, the most potent or poignant, really, is if someone's an unreal other, we don't sense their truth of their feelings and vulnerability, and we can hurt them. And we can do it because we're not sensing their realness. There's a saying I heard, when women are depressed, they eat or shop. When men are depressed or anxious, they attack another country. You know? It's kind of sad, isn't it? So when there's separation, when there's this trance of an other out there, it does lead, if we're scared, to violating, to get what we need. We can see it in personal conflicts. It's so easy to blame and sense the other as wrong. And then, of course, we see the cycles of war where it's almost like you can read it in the newspapers, but it's very hard to really grasp what's really happening. The children are losing their parents, and parents are losing their children, and people are losing their homes. And it's just hard to really get it from close in. For more of us, we can grasp how unreal other means the earth is unreal. And that we're beginning to wake up out of that, but we're beginning to see the devastation that's happened when greed run rampant with, you know, humans trying to control their environment and extract everything they can, and what we have done to this earth. One friend was telling me the other night about the polar bears, and they're just plain starving. And imagine if you could just watch a creature just starve and not be able to feed its babies. This is the words of Wendell Berry. "It is the destruction of the world in our own lives that drives us half insane and more than half. To destroy that which we were given in trust, how will we bear it?" So the question, how will we bear it, is really the key. Because if we don't bear it, if we shut down our attention, if we stay in our cocoon of self-centeredness, the violence goes on. The beginning of healing is to let ourselves listen and feel the hurt, the suffering, to let this life live through us. Some of you might know that the classic image of the Bodhisattva and description of the Bodhisattva of compassion is the one who's listening to the cries of the world, the cries of the suffering of our own wounded hearts, the cries of the world, and that in response there's a quivering of the heart. There's a visceral response of care when we let this life touch us. It wakes us up to the fullness of who we are. One friend was telling me today how his wife's illness brought out the best version of him because he let that touch him. When we slow down enough, see, we run away. I mean, that's the problem, is that our reflexes, when it's uncomfortable, get busy. When it's uncomfortable, feel guilty about it, but then armor ourselves. When it's uncomfortable, in some way numb ourselves. The bodhisattva practice, and this is the training, is, as we described last week, learning to stay. Kind of going against our conditioning and staying right here. I frequently describe this Rilke verse, I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may never complete the last one, but I give myself to it. That we are living in widening circles of awareness, and it's the hope of the future. It's the hope of evolution that our whole sense of being includes this world in our hearts. But we begin with the circle or the life that's right here. If we can't open to the shame and fear and real vulnerability that's there underneath our busyness, underneath our defenses, we won't be able to open the circles of being to include others in a genuine way. Our hearts won't quiver with that sense of presence. So this is the beginning of the bodhisattva training, is to learn to stay. And there's always this question, why would I want to feel pain if I could get away from it? But there's this kind of thing of why hang out? And it's not about groveling, and it's not about drowning in it. But there is a courageous kind of presence we develop not to run. Goes in conflict with George Carlin, some of you might remember. His motto was, no pain, no pain. So it's different. It's much more in the wisdom traditions that have these mandalas. Some of you might have seen them, the Tibetan mandalas, where there's these wrathful deities and these angry deities, these fearful deities, these shame-inducing deities. And in order to enter the center of the mandala, where there's peace and freedom, you have to go through the deities. And it's the same thing with entering a temple. You have to enter through the gates where the deities are. It's like saying we have these layers of our being that are raw and vulnerable. And we have to have the courage to say, yes, okay, I'll feel this. Which means to quiet the busyness of our mind that keeps us all over the place and say, here, what's right here, over and over again. Now, we can't fully be here with what's difficult unless there's a real atmosphere of care. Some of you might remember the story of a Hawaiian healer who said his whole practice was, when anyone was suffering or when he was suffering, to feel how it was in his body, the suffering, and keep sending the message over and over again, I'm sorry, I love you. That's all he did. He just would send this message, I'm sorry, I love you. I'm sorry, not an apology like I've sinned and now I'm sorry, but it's, I care about this. I care about this and I love you. It's this holding with love. And he said that if he could just keep on doing that, there would be a shift from being identified as the kind of small suffering self, the oppressed self, the victimized self, the wanting self, to being that compassionate presence that is really our home. So this is the Bodhisattva training. We start with this first circle of what's right here, and we can use the breath to help us. And we're going to practice for a moment and then explore widening the circles this evening. But we begin with where there might be vulnerability, fear, unease in our own hearts. And the breath is a wonderful tool because the breathing in is this willingness to let ourselves be touched by the suffering, not resist. Let the life live through us, okay? But the breathing out is really let it live through us. It doesn't mean we grab onto it or get possessed by it. We breathe out and remember the sky that has room for our cries and the earth that can absorb our tears. We remember the vastness. So let's just practice for a moment the beginning of compassion, which is really compassion for what some people call ourself, but it's really for the life that's here. It's a caring presence that we hold for the life right here. So we pause, and in this pause, just let your senses be awake. Let your senses be awake. So there's listening, sensing the space that the sound is happening in. Listening and feeling the aliveness of the body right here. The Bodhisattva aspiration begins, may whatever circumstances arise in my life, whatever they are, may they awaken this compassionate presence. That means whatever circumstances. It might mean that something's going wrong with our bodies. It may be that somebody we love is having trouble. It might mean that we've been fired. It might mean that we've just had a great loss in terms of a divorce. Whatever's happening, may this serve the awakening of compassionate presence. So you might check your life right now and sense, is there an area of difficulty? This first circle, this inner life that brings up fear or sadness, hurt, anger. Is there a difficult circumstance in your life right now? And to sense the intent, may this awaken compassion. Deepen compassion for the life that's here. And you might sense what's so difficult about it, just to let yourself honestly connect with what it brings up. If it's a loss, a wound, something you're afraid of, just to say, here, right here, let me feel what's right here about this. So the beginning of this training of compassion is to breathe in and let yourself be touched. Let yourself touch into and feel in your body the vulnerability. It's like you're saying, yes, I'll feel this. It's here and I'll open to it. breathing in and feeling just what's here. Maybe it's hard to get in touch with something and what you feel is numbness or sleepiness. That's okay. It's the same practice. It's an honest presence with what's here, not rejecting anything. Breathing in and feeling your body and your heart, but breathe out also and sense with the breathing out that you can let the life live through you, move through you. Remembering the space of the sky, the earth, the love that's big enough to hold whatever is here. The love that holds the grief, the love that holds the fear. Breathe out and let go into that. Hokusai says, live with the world inside you. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. So we breathe in and touch where it hurts. And we breathe out, I'm sorry, I love you. Sensing the space of love. As we let ourselves be touched by the vulnerability, we can begin to sense the vastness of the heart that's here, the compassionate presence that's really our home, that's who we are. You might extend this reflection and bring to mind everyone you can imagine that would be struggling with the same kind of pain, the same kind of sorrow. Just imagine that. Those that have the same losses, the same fears, so that now you're breathing in for all of us that suffer in this way. And breathing out, I care about this suffering, sensing the space that can hold it. It matters that life lives through this compassionate presence. So this is the training in awakening compassion. And the alchemy of compassion is very straightforward. If we're willing to touch the vulnerability directly, without any comment or resistance, without saying, I don't deserve to feel this, or I don't, or other people are suffering, or whatever it is, or it's going to be too much, we just directly feel, oh, ouch, this hurts. There'll be a natural tenderness. And in that space of tenderness, we can include the hurt and the pain and loss of others. It enlarges us. The full-blown bodhisattva aspiration that some of you might be familiar with is, may this life be of benefit to all beings through timeless existence. Now, when we reflect on that, may this life, right here, this life be of benefit to all beings through timeless existence, there can be this sense of, that's pretty grandiose, or that's a setup for burnout, right? Like, can I serve everybody through timeless existence? Or this fear, it's going to just overwhelm, you know? And the truth is, if we're identified as a separate self with this personality, thinking we're going to save the universe, then it is a setup for burnout and failure. But if we can serve from a place of belonging, that we hold this world in our hearts, there's another wonderful expression of the Bodhisattva of compassion, who was listening to the cries of all the world and trying to help all different parts of the world, every cry, responding to every cry. And it got so difficult, she exploded into 10 billion pieces because she was trying too hard to help everybody in every way. And then she exploded to these 10 billion pieces. And then all these kind of currents of the Bodhisattva then served appropriately in the particular area they were in. It doesn't mean this ego self has to serve timeless existence. It's this realization that we belong to this web of life. And what else is there to do if we care but to just help? Now what happens is that the trance of separateness and selfness on a daily basis, our urge to help and to really express our care, and gets contracted. And I want to name the ways it does, because part of waking up into a much more profound way of healing is to recognize how our self sense can end up contracting, and so that we're not really helping so much. And one of the ways that we end up contracting is that we think it's going to be just too much, and then we resign. That we think that it's that there's just too much trouble, and we're too small. And I'm going to come back to that. A second way that we end up contracting and then not really able to serve is that our care about the world turns into anger, and we get locked into bad person, wrong person. So there's an enemy out there. And this is one most of us know pretty well. I'll speak personally. I've shared in here how I can open the newspaper in the morning and without knowing it go into this trance where everything I'm reading is filtered into good guy, bad guy. Everything. And some of it, there's like a real sense of, you know, real venom or hostility or anger or outrage. And I want to say that it happens almost every day that I go into this trance still. As much as I try to talk about it, because I figure if I say it out loud here, I'll be a little more alert come breakfast tomorrow, you know. But I'll still read, you know, front page headlines, administration was the source of generating the firings, and then, you know, stick it to, you know, that whole energy that's very vindictive and good guy, bad guy. So I began a practice where as soon as I become aware of it, I will pause. And I'll pause and I'll feel that energy and I'll acknowledge it. Anger, vindictive, good guy, bad guy. And I'll wait and I'll feel in my body and I'll find under it that there's fear. Because I really am afraid for our world. It's scary. And then if I wait and stay open, it'll unfold into caring. And then I'll keep reading and I'll see still the inclination to divide the world and make enemies, but more there's just a kind of a tenderness of heart. Mahatma Gandhi is one of the great examples about that it doesn't, having this openness and not making an enemy doesn't mean that we become passive or inactive. He refused to let the British Empire be the enemy. Over and over again, he said, this isn't about hating the British, it's about sovereignty for India. He was not into an against something, he was into for. And what rallied people to him? He had this spiritual vision and openness that attracted Muslims and Hindus and so many people from different diverse backgrounds, because he had this light that really wasn't making an enemy. It was coming from love and caring. This is what he wrote. He said, I hold myself to be incapable of hating any being on earth. By a long course of prayerful discipline, I have ceased for over 40 years to hate anybody. I know this is a big claim. Nevertheless, I make it in all humility. So he talked about the British as kind of being a pain. And he said the Indian people were even worse. They were far more trouble. But he said the most difficult of all was a man named Mohandas G. Gandhi. With him, I have very little influence. That was the way he put it. So if this had the power to have the most powerful, this was to have the most powerful nation in the world back off. This is spiritual strength. So again, the inquiry tonight, what really allows us to bring our practice into the world, it's not the kind of helping or social activism that comes from hatred, that comes from making an enemy where our heart is angry and armored. The real power, the power that transforms in a deep way, not just makes temporary shifts of puppet governments or whatever it is, the deep transformation comes when in our own hearts we've realized our belonging, the loving presence that really is who we are, and we hold the world in our hearts. When we're undivided, if we're divided, our actions are going to have that twist of anger or grasping, and it's just going to plant the seeds for more cycles of violence. So Gandhi's way, as I've mentioned this here, was he took a day off each week, and he said that basically he needed a day of silence and prayer so he could act from the wisest part of his being. So this is how our meditation and our social activism and our activism to be loving with each other are completely intertwined. The first circle, we hold with compassion the life that's here, so we're not divided. You'll find that if you're going around feeling disconnected from other people, blaming other people, at odds with the world, you're going to be divided within your own heart, that there's a sense of not at home in here. So we begin, we over and over again come home. So I mentioned different ways that the sense of separation can prevent us from really healing in the world. And one way is that overwhelm, it's just too much, I'm a small self. Another way is making an enemy, other people wrong. Another way is to have pity on another, that we're serving because we think, oh, poor person. It's really easy to do. We so quickly have categories, so they're less fortunate, so we're helping. And this is, I think, the inspiration here. One of the great stories is Mother Teresa, which many of you know, where she was asked who she serves, and she says, I serve Christ, just Christ. And this is her language for what I might call loving presence. And she said, and everyone she serves is Christ in their distressing disguise. To have the eyes to go through the world and know that we're serving from our wholeness and we're serving the wholeness and divinity in each other. That's what allows the healing to be transformative, not in some way adding another layer of separation. So how do we train to begin to wake up out of this incredible deep conditioning to walk through the world and create unreal others that are either better than us, threatening us, have something to offer to us, that we pity, that are our enemy? We do it so quickly. So one of the simple practices that I like to do, and I'll just invite you to check out just for a moment, is just to, again, pause and close your eyes. And as we've been doing tonight, as you pause, let yourself arrive right here. Just sense here-ness. Gently. Listening. Feeling in the body. Feeling if there's any vulnerability, discomfort, and just sensing how that lives in you. Now take a moment to bring to mind someone that's close to you that might be having a difficult time. Someone you know. And just let that person come right into your awareness here and see them and remember what you remember about them. Just review what it's like, what you know about them. Maybe the last time you were together. Anything that comes to mind about this person. How their voice sounds, how they look, whatever comes to mind. And then take another breath. And come back right here again, drop ideas and just sense again your presence right here. Sounds. Sense what your heart feels like. Right here. Sense your own awareness, aware of being aware. And consider that the person you are reflecting on is more like this subjectivity, this awareness, this vulnerability from the inside. This listening, this feeling, more like this than any story you could have about them. It says, Henry David Thoreau says, the greatest miracle is to look through another's eyes for even a moment. So we begin this practice of really coming home to our own vulnerability and subjectivity so we can begin to sense, okay, those that we encounter, who's here? Who is here? It's like T.S. Eliot in The Cocktail Party says, what we know of other people is only our memory of the moments during which we knew them, and they have changed since then. We must also remember that at every meeting, we are meeting a stranger. Can we move through the world and pause and attend? There's a story that was one of my kind of wake-ups on this that I've shared with some of you about a year or two ago. I find it so valuable. I'd like to bring it in tonight to this talk. It's written by a Unitarian minister, and it's a true story. She says, it was Sunday, Christmas. Our family had spent the holidays in San Francisco with my husband's parents, but in order for us to be back to work on Monday, we found ourselves driving the 400 miles home to Los Angeles on Christmas Day. It was normally an 8-hour drive, but with kids, it can be a 14-hour endurance test. When we could stand it no longer, we stopped for lunch in King City. This little metropolis is made up of 6 gas stations and 3 diners, and it was into one of those diners the 4 of us trooped, road-weary and saddle-sore. As I sat Eric, our 1-year-old, in the high chair, I looked around the room and wondered, what am I doing in this place? The restaurant was near empty. We were the only family, and ours were the only children. My reverie was interrupted when I heard Eric squeal with glee. Hi there. 2 words he thought were one. Hi there. He pounded his fat baby hands, whack, whack, on the metal high chair tray. His face was alive with excitement, eyes wide, gums bared in a toothless grin. He wriggled and chirped and giggled, and then I saw the source of his merriment, and my eyes could not take it in all at once. A tattered rag of a coat, obviously bought by someone eons ago, dirty, greasy. Baggy pants, both they and the zipper at half-mast over a spindly body. A shirt that had ring around the collar all over and a face like none other. Gums as bare as Eric's, hair uncombed, unwashed. whiskers too short to be called a beard, but way, way beyond a shadow, and a nose so varicose that it looked like a map of New York. I was too far away to smell him, but I knew he smelled, and his hands were waving in the air, flapping about on loose wrists. "Hi there, baby. Hi there, big boy. I see you, Buster." My husband and I exchanged a look that was a cross between "What do we do?" and "Poor devil." Eric continued to laugh and answer, "Hi there." Every call was echoed. I noticed waitresses' eyebrows shoot to their foreheads and several people sitting near us out loud. This old geezer was creating a nuisance with my beautiful baby. I shoved a cracker at Eric. He pulverized it on the tray. I whispered, "Why me?" under my breath. Our meal came and the nuisance continued. Now the old bum was shouting from across the room, "Do you know patty cake? Attaboy, you know peekaboo? Hey, look, he knows peekaboo." Nobody thought it was cute. The guy was probably drunk and a definite disturbance. I was embarrassed. My husband, Dennis, was humiliated. Even our six-year-old said, "Why is that old man talking so loud?" We ate in silence, except Eric, who was running through his repertoire for the admiring applause of his Skid Row bum. Finally, I had enough. I turned the high chair. Eric screamed and clamored around to face his old buddy. Now I was really mad. Dennis went to pay the check, imploring me to get Eric and meet me in the parking lot. I trundled Eric out of the high chair, and I looked directly toward the exit. The old man sat poised and waiting, his chair directly between me and the door. "Lord, just let me out of here before he speaks to me or Eric," I headed toward the door. It soon became apparent that both the Lord and Eric had other plans. As I drew closer to the man, I turned my back, walking to sidestep him and any air he might be breathing. As I did so, Eric, all the while with his eyes riveted to his best friend, leaned far over my arm, reaching with both arms in a baby's pick-me-up position. In a split second of balancing my baby and turning to counter his weight, I came eye to eye with the old man. Eric was lunging for him, arms spread wide. The bum's eyes both asked and implored, "Would you let me hold your baby?" There was no need for me to answer, since Eric propelled himself from my arms to the man's. Suddenly, a very old man and a very young babe were involved in a love relationship. Eric laid his tiny head on the man's ragged shoulder. The man's eyes closed, and I saw tears hover beneath his lashes. His aged hands, full of grime and pain and hard labor, gently, so gently, cradled my baby's bottom and stroked his back. I stood awestruck. The old man rocked and cradled Eric in his arms for a moment, and then his eyes opened and set squarely on mine. He said in a firm, commanding voice, "You take care of this baby." Somehow I managed, "I will," from a throat that contained a stone. He pried Eric from his chest, unwillingly, longingly, as though he was in pain. I held my arms open to receive my baby, and again the gentleman addressed me. "God bless you, ma'am. You've given me my Christmas gift." I said nothing more than a muttered thanks. With Eric back in my arms, I ran for the car. Dennis wondered why I was crying and holding Eric so tightly, and why I was saying, my God, forgive me." So this is the kind of teaching that can we begin to look on the face of any man or woman and see that they're our brother and our sister? Can we really slow down enough? And it takes slowing down. It takes slowing down. Can we slow down enough to really see who's here? To know that everybody we meet is struggling hard. You know, it's said that if you stop to be kind, you must swerve often from your path. We're on our way somewhere. Can we slow down and see who's here? Can we see that everyone we meet has losses, has a body that's getting older, has losing people they love, and is living in this basic insecurity that we're all in? Can we slow down enough and see the intrinsic goodness that everyone wants to love and be loved? Can we hold the world in our hearts? One of teacher I love, Sri Nisargadatta, says that if things get difficult, drop everything but just one phrase in your mind. I am God, you are God. I am God, you are God. That's it. When we meet someone, just drop everything else. It's very easy in this trance of separation to feel like we're too small and the problems are too big. And yet when we start to open, there's a natural way of responding to what's here. And it's almost like, as I mentioned at the beginning, toxic or poisonous to not offer ourselves, to not help. And it's also part of our illusion that it's too big and things are too bad. We can, with the very next person we meet, we can slow down enough and sense who's there to look in the eyes of that person and see the soul that's there. We can have our actions come from an undivided place, and whether it's political activism or it's prayer, we can live with that caring in an open way. Tell me the weight of a snowflake, a coal mouse asked a wild dove. Nothing more than nothing was the answer. In that case, I must tell you a marvelous story, the coal mouse said. I sat on a branch of a fir close to its trunk when it began to snow. Not heavily, not in a giant blizzard, no, just like in a dream, without any violence. Since I didn't have anything better to do, I counted the snowflakes settling on the twigs and needles of my branch. Their number was exactly 3,741,952. When the next snowflake dropped onto the branch, nothing more than nothing, as you say, the branch broke off. Having said that, the coal mouse flew away. The dove, since Noah's time and authority on change, thought about the story for a while and finally said to herself, perhaps there is only one person's voice lacking for peace to come about in this world. So let's just take a few moments again to come home, to sense these widening circles of being, to let the presence right here be the gateway. We always start right here to be authentically awake in this heart. In a simple way, just to feel your intention. May this heart be awake. May I realize and inhabit loving presence. Live with the world inside you. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. May all beings be filled with loving kindness, be held with loving kindness. May all beings touch natural and great peace. May there be peace on earth. May there be peace on earth. May there be peace on earth and everywhere. May all beings awaken and be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.